This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Although I'd be reluctant to ever speak of stages or steps in our practice, it might be useful to describe two dimensions of practice, two sides that may occupy the foreground or background to different degrees at different times. What we usually foreground is what we tell people in beginner's instruction, that sitting is like sitting down in front of a mirror. Your face automatically appears, and it's the mirror that's doing all the work. You can't do it right or wrong. You're simply there looking at what emerges and watching your reaction to it. Now, I think that probably for most of us, the majority of our time, for many, many years, we'll be engaged at that level of simply trying to stay honestly present with what emerges moment after moment, and noticing our aversion to a great deal of it. That aversion will manifest in terms of self-judgment, shame, anxiety, attempts to control our mind or get lost in distractions. And it's very easy, as I've written about, to turn practice into a secret practice of fixing up what we see in the mirror, buffing up our self-image to remove all the parts that we don't like and try to create something idealized and spiritual. But the real work for practice for most of us is being able to spend long hours sitting and experiencing those parts of ourselves that we see in the mirror that we came to practice to eliminate. Now, I would say that gradually we may be aware of a different dimension in practice that's what I call an emergent property that comes out of the first. That's simply as we spend a lot of time simply leaving ourselves alone and learning to stand that, we can develop a habit of being present that gradually becomes self-reinforcing. We find that we don't reflexively avoid being present to ourselves. We find that maybe we can sit here without distraction. Maybe we can sit here without thinking all the time, am I there yet? Is this the way it's supposed to be? Am I doing it right? Gradually we can just get tired of those judgments and questions and efforts. And then we might find ourselves just for a few moments in a given sitting, just sitting, having the experience of our body breathing, and that not being a step towards anything in particular, but just being the moment as it is, nothing particularly special about it. In many ways, it's more the absence of something than the presence of something. But we might find ourselves more and more willing and able just to stay with the body and the breath, just because that is in fact what's happening. We're sitting and we're breathing. And in doing that, we're not accomplishing anything. We've simply stopped running away from ourselves or running towards something that we set up at the horizon that we've been chasing in our mind for all these years in the name of spirituality. If we just sit, we find ourselves really just sitting for its own sake, for the sake of sitting. And it's sort of an odd thing to do. And yet, we may also find that in unpredictable ways, that generalizes for the rest of our life. Where we may be asking ourselves questions about what is the meaning of what am I doing? What's it for? What's it add up to? And usually, practice will organize itself around, again, two kinds of themes. One of which says very grounded simply in the activity of being present for its own sake. And similar way that our life is simply lived for its own sake, whatever its content. We just do the next thing and have that experience. But we also might find ourselves, when we move out of a self-centered preoccupation with how am I doing, and move out of a preoccupation of perfecting ourselves or becoming enlightened as an antidote to our habitual self-hate, we might get organized towards something we think of as compassion or serving others or serving a higher cause, something like justice, democracy, peace. And here again, we have to often go through a long process where we sort out the experience of doing these things for their own sake, for the sake of our wholehearted participation in them, versus whatever outcome we think we're going to bring about or whatever doing those things contributes to our self-image as a good person. Because in the long run, any cause we dedicate ourselves to is likely not to be unattainable, but to be subject to many, many factors out of our control and not ever attainable once and for all. We're going to have to come back to the experience of simply making the effort of doing something that feels good or right for its own sake, even if we can't always see or measure an outcome. It's a funny thing about contemplative traditions, the way they, in some sense, have to justify themselves when they put a great deal of effort into separating themselves from the world and living a certain kind of ascetic or austere life in order to do what exactly? And in a certain kind of model, it's as if we're suffering from a very intractable disease, and it's only by putting ourselves through such a difficult and rigorous cure that we can hope to cure ourselves of delusion and awaken into our true nature. But what will that look like then? See, the thing about that model is that once we awaken, it's not as if we then say, well, I'm cured of that, I don't have to do this anymore. We just keep doing it. Somehow the whole contemplative life and practice is its own justification. It's not actually a means to any end at all. Now, often traditions, for one reason or another, try to put around themselves the idea that our prayers or our practice generates merit for all beings, does something for the souls of the departed in their progress towards rebirth. Western contemplative societies used to describe themselves as engines of prayer, sending up prayers to God on behalf of all humanity. In a certain sense, it was hard to say, well, we just live this way because we like it. Or we want to stop doing something that we think is really foolish and pointless and probably destructive, the way the ordinary people live. We want to live without doing harm. We'd like to model something about simplicity and not living a life of getting and spending. But then you really have to say that the life is primarily a model for its own sake. This is just simply a good way to live. Modern communities are a little more comfortable having that kind of frame around themselves, particularly if they now sort of think of what they're modeling is simplicity and sustainability in the midst of a consumer culture. therefore they model. This could be a good life for people. You don't have to go around chasing all the things you think you need in order to be happy. It's possible to have deep satisfaction from very unexpected sources. But I think that all these things come around in the end to some deep version of no gain, that we're not really engaged in anything that's a means to an end, but that we're really trying to settle into our life, settle into an appreciation of our life. And we do that trying to simply settle into an appreciation of each moment and each breath. And the temptation is always to turn that again into some project that we're going to master and do well and generate a certain feeling. And that's why I don't like to separate that out as a separate step or stage, because immediately people will begin to think it's something they have to do better or do more of. And I like more the idea that it's simply what emerges from our sitting when we leave ourselves alone. That this is our life. Let's appreciate it together.